And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Linda Lloyd, and it's my pleasure to welcome Donna Everhart, the author of The Education of Dixie Dupree, published by Kensington Books. Her debut novel has just been selected as an Amazon Best Book, a Library Journal Book Club selection, and was the Indy Next pick for November 2016. Dixie, an expert liar at age 11, tells us a story about coming of age in Alabama, family secrets, and lessons that can never be forgotten. Donna, Dixie Dupree is an 11-year-old girl from Alabama who describes herself as stubborn as Alabama dirt. She's also extremely angry, especially with her mother.
Right.
How did this 11-year-old, who's very insightful in places, also get to be who she is, and why is she so angry?
Well, she wasn't originally in the, probably, of course, you know, like any child in the beginning of their life, the early years. But as time progressed and she began to learn that this perfect family that she thought she had was not so perfect. And there was this aggravation with her mother. She did not understand why her mother was wanting to go back to New Hampshire. So she's living in Alabama, and she's born in Alabama. Her brother's born in Alabama, her father. But her mother came from New Hampshire. And then when these little bits and pieces started to come together, and this perfect family that she thought she had starts to fall apart, she begins to get mad at her mother. Like, why would she want to leave this place that we love, that Daddy loves? And as time went on and her mother's persistence about wanting to go back to New Hampshire began to take a toll. And then, of course, I don't know where your questions are going to go, but then there's the whole aspect of her mother sort of teaching her to lie on her behalf.
And that is a big question I had, because one of the things that she says when she goes to school with bruises, her teacher is very inquisitive, and she keeps asking her the same questions over and over again. And she says, the only answers I've got are the ones I wish were true to begin with.
Right.
Why did her mother begin to teach her this lying skill? Is it part of the background that Evie herself had, and she's become a liar, skilled in it over the years, so now she, is it a protectionism that she wants to teach Dixie?
I think so. I think it's all of that. And when you have secrets to hide, what are you going to do? You're going to lie. And especially as those secrets get bigger and bigger. And for Evie, the mother, we know she had a lot of secrets. And I probably won't talk too much about that because I don't like the spoiler thing. But, you know, she's got a lot of her own secrets. But then there's the fact of what she's doing to Dixie. And oh my gosh, it's some pretty bad things. She's abusive. She's an abusive mother with Dixie. And this feeling that she has of being a misfit in Alabama. So the initial sort of catalyst for this whole lying begins when there is that incident between Dixie and her mother that one morning. And there is some abuse involved. And then the father gets the in-laws involved. And it's like Evie is going to be questioned by the in-laws. And it makes her furious. And so she basically has Dixie lie to cover up. And Dixie goes with it because she wants to do what her mother wants her to do. You know, she's trying to please her mother so that she can get that love she's seeking from her mother.
But it just seems to magnify her bad behavior. And I thought, is this one of those cases where any attention is better than no attention?
It is. It's that. It's almost like Dixie, she's smarter probably than, you know, she needs to be. She's very sharp. She's very observant. She sees these things going on around her. So her lying becomes a way to protect her mother, but it also becomes a way to spite her mother. She kind of does it just because, as she says. And she does it, in her own words, to piss her mother off. And then she does it as well to protect her mother. So it's almost like she's walking two fine lines here. You know, on the one hand, she's doing it just to get the attention, and then she's doing it to protect her mother because she gets very defensive, you know, about the things that
Absolutely.
Happen on behalf of her mother. And then sometimes she's also doing, it's almost like these three reasons, she's doing it to protect all of them because there are some risks involved further on in the book that she recognizes and sees the what ifs. So what if this happens, what's going to happen? So she begins to lie to cover all of these things up and then some. It just kind of like a domino effect, you know, just bump, 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 one thing right after the other.
And then, of course, at some point, you have to keep lying to cover up what you've already lied about.
Right.
So I guess Dixie finds herself trapped in that situation.
Exactly.
But Evie's in such a precarious position because she is so different from everybody. She mm-hmm. doesn't really fit in Alabama. And her in-laws certainly don't make it easy for her to do that.
They don't.
After that incident, Charles's father pretty much threatened her and was going to teach her a lesson.
Exactly. And that is not meant to be amusing or funny, but the way Evie relays that incident to Dixie's Aunt Margie, which is her sister-in-law, I've had some readers come up and say that they laughed out loud at that part where she knocked his glasses. I mean, they get into this sort of physical altercation because Charles Dupree's father was old school. Women should be in the kitchen cooking up the supper. They don't want them to talk. They don't have an opinion. And, of course, this is 1969 Alabama, Southern culture. And they're just supposed to be quiet. And Evie's threatening to be sort of like this women's liber and go around braless. And Charles Dupree is, I'll be damned, you're not doing that. And so, anyway, there's this incident, you know, with the in-laws. And the father-in-law thinks that he's going to show his son, well, this is what you got to do. And he literally grabs her up, and boy, she goes crazy. She goes crazy on him and knocks his glasses off and says she saw spit fly out of his mouth when she knocks his glasses off clear across the room. You know? So it's not meant to be funny because you can imagine being in that situation with somebody. You are so furious. How dare, in her mind, it's how dare he put his hands on me. How dare he tell me to be quiet? This is not who I am and not how I was raised. Again, being from New Hampshire, that was one of the scenes, again, not meant to be sort of a funny scene, but there was a little bit of humor in that, how she stood up for herself and did have some of that backbone.
Well, do you think that that's the reason that Dixie stayed so confused and was always so curious and watched her mother so closely? Because she was always trying to figure her mother out.
She was always eavesdropping to try to get as much information as she could. So this is how she learned so much. She had that little special spot behind the couch that she would tuck herself into. And she would talk about, boy, it's getting so good. I might as well get up and get me some Jiffy Pop popcorn. But she didn't want to miss anything. And this is where she began to piece together the fragility of that family that she thought was so strong and really comes to understand that it's not as she thought it was.
Why do you think so much of the abuse was toward Dixie, though, rather than to her brother? Because, I mean, he was there, too. It was almost like she was trying to teach Dixie to be stronger than he was.
Well, there's that physical part of it, too, the physical way that Dixie looked. Dixie reminded Evie of herself. And it's almost like she's trying to beat whatever she saw in herself that she didn't like, she's trying to beat it out of Dixie. And I think that's where, at least in my way of writing the story, where I was coming from. And yet she put Dixie's brother, AJ, up on a pedestal because he looked, of course, a lot like the Duprees, but yet a lot like her family in New Hampshire, the blonde hair, the blue eyes. Whereas Dixie, the brown hair, the brown eyes, just like Evie herself. And, of course, there's a huge reveal at the end of the book, you know,
right,
that readers will come to understand what that is all about. Because Dixie had said for herself, and their mama and I were like misfits. Evie probably saw that, and she's probably thinking, I don't like that about myself, and I don't want her, whatever that was, whether it's physical, whether it's the personality. But there were so many parts of Dixie that were just like her mother, and I think this is where she's trying to change her course.
And that was what Dixie was always trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. You know, mother kept telling me that I was so much like her.
Right.
And
right.
So I'm constantly
watching. So she
would
look at herself, trying to turn her thoughts inward. Well, what is it about me that makes me so much like her? But then again, you know, her mother would turn around and be abusive to her, which was so hurtful.
Why do you think her mother gave her the diary?
In a diary, and I've said this, you're not lying to anyone. You're truthful to yourself. And I feel that she could not tell Dixie herself exactly what was going on. She had her own diary. She had some truths in there that she was ready to now share, considering what has happened to Dixie. Of course, I start the very beginning of the book is almost like the ending
end of the book. Right.
And I allude to it and I drop the hints of, you know, there's something there that's happened, and it's going to be revealed further as the reader goes into the story. But there's enough of what Dixie begins to read. And, of course, Evie's truth is all in there, just like Dixie couldn't lie to her own self when she wrote in her diary. She wrote everything down, and her mother had done the same thing. And so I think her mother realizes this is where we have to start. First, she needs to absorb this is what it is, and this is what has happened. And then, of course, they end up talking about it.
Dixie calls her diary her best friend.
That's right.
And that was the person, or the thing, I guess, that she used for some of that introspection. But in the end, it was good that she had that, because it was also a record of everything that had happened.
Exactly.
When she had to give up the diary to Mr. Evans, what did that mean to Dixie?
She says it's like losing a hand. You know, it's something that's been there. You depend on it like a hand, like your right hand. And it was so important to her. It was, as she said, my best friend. What am I going to do without my best friend? It was the one thing that she could open up her heart to and speak honestly and truthfully. And to give it up was probably the most difficult thing as an 11-year-old. And their world, you know, is very much smaller than the adult world as far as their outlook. And so she had centered herself all into that diary. And, of course, there's that little beginning at the first part of the book where she's talking about how Mr. Evans has reached for it and she has extended it, but she can't let it go right away.
Right.
And so he immediately releases it and lets her have that time to relinquish it on her own. And then she does.
The one thing that I didn't understand, Charles knows how miserable his wife is. Why don't they go back to New Hampshire, at least for a visit? Is he so afraid that she'll want to stay?
I think when someone, as we know, Charles is an alcoholic, and this is something that Evie did not know. And I think people, once they get into that state, I mean, we talk about Evie being depressed. I think Charles was too. You know, of course, the way he handled it was through his drinking. And you are just not really thinking, maybe coherently. And I think that's a little bit of it. And I also think that there was some fear there, because he realized, especially once she started talking about wanting to go back to New Hampshire, that's the last thing we need to do. And of course, there's that first initial few years of their life. I mean, the story starts off when Dixie's 11, and then we step back to when she's only 8, and we're just there for a brief period of time. But that's when it all starts to fall apart. And so you've got this young family, Evie coming down for reasons, again, that are revealed at the end of the book, and you've got her meeting Charles. And you've got him declaring his love for her. I mean, it was truly love at first sight for him.
Right.
She was in a desperate situation. She needed somebody to lean on. And so she saw him as this kind person who could help her. And so she agrees to marry him. And next thing you know, they're having these children. And so they're trying to initially establish their lives. So for him, I think it became this thing where, well, you know, I built her this house and she should be happy and we've been happy. But not really. Evie has probably had a little bit of this percolating homesickness going on. And then they never do make it back because he begins to feel unsure and in doubt and scared, and I'm going to lose her, and I love her, and I don't want to lose her, and I'm afraid if we go back, she will never want to leave, which, of course, kind of became a dual-edged sword because that was, of course, Dixie's fear, too. She carried, and she didn't even know that probably about her father, whatever he was thinking about it at the time. But she, of course, tried to quiz him about her mother. I think for him it was just this tremendous fear that she wouldn't want to leave. And, of course, that in turn, maybe even without any clarity between those two, her father and herself, that this is also what she began to fear about going to New Hampshire.
Well, and later in the story, when they actually do go to visit, you can sort of understand that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like two different worlds.
Exactly.
Do you think that the Duprees are sort of a Southern stereotype in ways?
Well, the Duprees are Southerners. You know, there's all kinds of Southerners. You know, we have the genteel. We have the folks that are in the farming community. We have, just like any place else in the United States or anywhere in the world, you've got a conglomeration or a mix, you know, of different personality types and different ways of life and different cultures. They were country folk. They weren't farming. You know, the grandfather was a mechanic. The father was something of a mechanic and worked on things with his hands. And that's what Dixie was used to, you know, seeing people in kind of work clothes and coveralls and not so dressed up and, as she called it, in church clothes, you know, like on a regular day of the week, they're wearing something like what they would wear to church. For the Duprees, I didn't see them that way. I didn't see them as a stereotype. I just saw them as being good old country folks, you know, and very tight-knit. So, and then here comes Evie out of the clear blue, it seems, kind of plopped into their midst. And as Dixie has observed, like a misfit. She just did not fit.
Well, one of the things that I thought was insightful for her was at one point Dixie asked whether you hurt those you've loved to prove your love to them. And that's so hard for me to see this 11-year-old look at this and go, well, it's okay to be abusive because that's how you let people know that you love them.
Right. It's twisted. It's sick. It's not right. We really don't want to purposefully hurt anybody that we love. I mean, and we do so unintentionally. Oftentimes we do that unintentionally. And I mean, I do it, you know, I mean, we all do it and we hate it, especially when we recognize it. And sometimes we do it without even realizing.
Exactly.
And so for me, it was that tender-hearted moment of in my own feelings when I was writing that particular declaration from Dixie's viewpoint. It was something that was sort of an epiphany that she was coming to understand because of the way they lived, the way they interacted with one another, the things that were happening. She began to have this sort of warped sense of, well, okay, this is what love is. It's when you hurt somebody. And it's true, that actually can be the case. I mean, there's that discipline that your mother gives you, you know, that hurts you. Of course, it's not the abusive discipline,
right,
but it is that tough love, as they call it. And of course, Dixie was getting something, unfortunately, different from tough love, but that's how she's looking at it. Well, they must love me because Mama wouldn't care so much about me unless she was doing these things. It's twisted. You know, it's definitely not the norm for an 11-year-old. Like I said, I think that for me in writing that part, it was sort of recognizing that with her thought process.
Well, another thing that I got irritated with Evie about is that she blamed her kids when things went wrong.
Right.
Why are you making me do this to you? It wasn't like, you know, she had any responsibility. It was like they were causing her to do things.
Look at what you made me do.
Right.
I mean, if you think about that, that's almost that typical abusive relationship. And I can only speak personally for myself, but I have met a couple of those people. I've had a couple of those people in my life And it's never them who are the ones at fault. It's always you. Look what you made me do. And that's where that comes from. You know, I mean, again, all writers kind of write a little bit of what they know. And I thought about that while this was going on, that there needed to be a little bit of that coldness to Evie, because there had to be some sort of a rationale or a way that I had to kind of get into her head and think, okay, why would any mother be doing this? And so she's a little off balance or unhinged, mm-hmm. you know, because of her depression. That was one of the things, particularly in that one incident with the tablecloth, where she is probably so ashamed and cannot hardly believe what she has now done. And initially in her anger, she's blaming it. And then afterwards, there's this tremendous sense of guilt that starts to creep in to these habits that she's formed.
Well, and then Charles goes away. He decides that, you know, he's going to leave, and they're left alone, and her brother comes.
Right.
And that starts a completely different type of situation. Why did she not recognize her brother for what he was and the relationship with the children? Why did she not see that?
She did. In the story, she doesn't explain this, of course, until the end, and part of this is in the diary that Dixie reads at the very beginning, that we don't know, you know, exactly what she has uncovered until the end of the book. But she believed that through the course of time, AJ is now 13, and it has been 13 years since she has seen her brother, maybe even a little bit longer, but we'll just say 13 years. And she believes that things have to have changed at this point. She is so desperate. The children are hungry. They're starving. She has enough pride that she does not want to accept help from her elderly parents, her aging parents, even though they were willing to do that, you know. For whatever reason, in Evie's mind, and maybe it's a little bit of that wanting to sort of reconnect, and despite what happens between all of her family members up north, you still have that love that you have for your family.
Right.
And so she accepts Ray's help, and that 13-year gap in her mind is sufficient enough to have put the boundaries there. There's that boundary that she believes is there. There's that length of time that's there. And she believes, to be sure, he has changed. And so she allows him back in. And she feels like she can keep an eye on things. And she can make sure that everything is copacetic, so to speak.
Well, you said that you wrote about what you know. Did something like this happen to you in your childhood?
A little bit. Not to the degree of what happens with Dixie. But there was an uncle. And this happened when I was in third and fourth grade. And actually, it happened when I was in Michigan. My parents, I lived in North Carolina all my life, except for that two-year period where we went to Michigan. And my father was actually working for Chrysler Corporation up there. And we had a couple of uncles up there, aunts. These were my mother's relatives. She's actually from Maine, but a few of the relatives had gone over to Michigan. And so they had been telling her, you know, Claude, my father's name, should come up north, should come here to Michigan because he's a good mechanic and he could easily get a job here, more pay. So come on up. And so we did. I mean, it was very risky. When I think back on it now, my parents, similar to Charles and Evie, and my brother, 17 months older than me, and there we go, off to Michigan for a couple of years. There was this uncle. Inappropriate things happened with him, but not to the level here with Dixie.
Is that one of the reasons that you decided to write? Or how did you become a writer? This is your first published book, but I know you've been writing for a while.
Right. Actually, I did not intend for The Education of Dixie Dupree to be in any way related to anything that happened to me. I mean, obviously, there are a couple of little parallels there. Mother from the north, father from the south, older brother, little bit of the uncle thing going on. I mean, but that was so, whereas Dixie's is, you know, at the 150% level, mine was more down at the 20 to 30% level, if that makes sense, you know, with the type of thing that was going on. But for me, it's truly more about the fact that I am first and foremost a reader, and there is nothing more impactful than when you read a book and it makes your heart race and it makes you become very emotional. Either you love it and you're emotional in the way that is a very positive and uplifting thing, or you're just absolutely, oh my gosh, what is going to happen? I can't wait to see what happens. You know, there's just that thrill when you're reading a really good book and you can't wait to get to it again. And so I had had a few books like that that impacted me that way, more than a few, quite, you know, a lot. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to be able to impact people the same way, to have them sit down and read something that would affect them emotionally like it did for me. And that was really, truly kind of the catalyst for me for wanting to get into writing, just the desire to do that.
Is there a message with this book? Is there something you'd like for your readers to get from that?
There is, actually. I did a lot of research about this particular topic, about abuse, and in particular with the sexual abuse. And it just so happens that what I wanted to convey is that you can have something like this happen to you, and you can be okay without having any therapy. Now, that hasn't hit some people the right way. They believe that I'm trying to advocate for the idea that having therapy or whatever the choice is for a person to make when something like this happens, that going in that direction or not needing that is what I'm trying to say, and that's not what I'm trying to say at all. What I'm trying to say is that there are a few of us out here, and I use the word us because I never had therapy, and I have become a fully functional member of society without any, you know, sense of needing that. And I actually, when I was doing the research, the Department of Justice National Sex Offender Public Website. It's kind of this long name, but this is where I learned that 40% of children are asymptomatic. And then there was this one reviewer who made the comment, she remembered a little story, and I cannot remember this well-known psychiatrist. And this young woman came in to see him, and she was worried. She was a victim of sexual abuse. And she was worried. But what she was worried about was not the fact that she had been sexually abused, but the fact that she wasn't worried about being sexually abused. And that's what she was worried about.
That she felt like something was wrong because
yeah,
she didn't react
exactly
the way that it was typical to act.
Exactly. Like, oh my gosh, this has happened to me, and why am I not worried about it? And I should be worried about this, and I should be affected by this, and I should, you know, maybe seek counseling. And he said, if you're not worried about it and you are happy, go on with your life. There's nothing wrong with you. If this is what has happened to you and you have put it over here and you know this has happened to you and you understand that this has happened to you and you are, you know, not to say that you're okay with it, but if you are functioning and you're happy and you don't feel depressed, live your life. Don't worry about it.
Well, I wonder if there are people who, like Dixie, she knew what was going on was wrong and she knew it wasn't her fault.
Right.
And do you think that makes a difference? I mean, do you think some people feel like it's their fault that this has happened?
I think that's exactly it. I think that's hitting the nail on the head. There is a lot of that self-blame, like, what did I do? You know, this shouldn't be happening. What did I do? How could this be happening to me? And for whatever reason, and maybe this is a little bit of my own bit in here, I knew what my uncle was doing, that he should not be doing it. I knew that. And that could be partially why I managed it the way I managed it, which was to just be aware and to know about it and to understand it. And that was that, sort of like compartmentalizing it. And I have that part of my life that's here, but that's a very small, minute fraction of my life. It's not what my life is.
Right.
And I think that's what I'm writing, the direction that I'm coming from with Dixie, that she recognizes this and she hates this. She hates that this has happened because, you know, again, she references a little bit of how she feels about it towards the end of the book with the circumstances of what happened with her. But at the same time, she knows she has this vision in her mind of where she wants to go. You know, it's not long-term vision, it's short-term vision. But for a child at that point, they don't look long-term anyway.
Right.
She just looks forward to, I want to be maybe make friends with Susan Smith in school. I want to continue to get good grades. And I just want to go home and be with Mama and AJ. And that's good enough for me.
But I think that she's a remarkable little girl in that she is able to separate the abuse from her mother's love. In some respects, she sort of understands that her father is also depressed. I mean, she sort of sees all of that, which mm-hmm. seems to me very unusual for a child that age. But then she talks about other things in her diary, and you go, do all little girls think this way? And we just don't give them credit for that.
Right. I mean, I had a question last night asked of me, how did I get into the head of an 11-year-old girl? How did I decide what would seem authentic and in touch with the thought processes of an 11-year-old child? Well, we've all been there. We've all been children at some point in our life, and we all have memories of how we handle things. Some of us are more mature at that age. Of course, kids nowadays, I mean, they beat us by a stretch. They're all very sophisticated. I would feel like a child that is 11 years old today is probably more like the 20-year-olds used to be back in our time frame, you know, in the 50s, 60s time frame. And so for me, when I was going through the process of writing how Dixie was so intuitive and so in touch with understanding some of the dynamics of her family and the relationships going on, I could recognize seeing some of these things. I mean, I don't know if I want to say that I was precocious as a child in that way. I probably was to a degree. But we all have had those experiences with our family members. And I can give you a perfect example of this. Children have this innate sense of fairness. They know, even from a very, very much younger age than Dixie, I mean, even at the age of 5, if you punish a child for doing something that they didn't do, and they know they didn't do it, they know that's not right. They know that is not fair. And so you have Dixie, who's 11, much older than a 5-year-old, who has that sense of fairness without it ever having been taught that. And it's almost like instinctual, you know? So she sees how her family inner workings are going on, and she's an observer. She observes these things, and she can make her own conclusions, and she's smart enough to do that. I mean, we know she's smart, you know,
absolutely,
just given how she reacts to some things and the questions that she's feeding us through her narrative. Even as a child within my own family, when we were in Michigan, and of course, I'm only 8, 9 years old at that time, and I can remember seeing the family dynamic up there and recognizing it. And with any of my relatives, you know, even down south, when we came back down to North Carolina, you sort of know what to say and what not to say as a child around the adults.
I think that's something that you learn pretty quickly. And definitely Evie was good about teaching her kids what they could and couldn't say, because
right.
it might reveal some of what was going on if they didn't do that.
And there was the fear factor. As you know, we had Dixie, who was being sort of threatened by the uncle and held in a, I don't know, I'm trying to think of what the phrase is I want to use, but almost like blackmail. It was blackmail. But she had enough sense to see that anyway. She was already kind of thinking ahead of time, but if I said anything, what could happen? She's thinking ahead. She's thinking about Mrs. Upchurch.
And she's thinking about protecting her family.
Right.
Because that's what it was, ultimately.
She didn't want to be separated from
right.
her family.
And she knew that that could happen after the experience she had already had
right.
at school.
Right.
Well, what's next for you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I actually ended up with some really good news just in the past week, but the very next thing on the horizon, the next novel is called The Road to Bittersweet, and that's going to be coming out in January of 2018, so just a little less than a year from now. And that is a story, another coming-of-age story, another strong protagonist. It's a very different story than The Education of Dixie Dupree. It's set in 1940 in the North Carolina Appalachian Mountains, and it's about a musical family. Their name is the Stampers. Young girl's name, she's 14 years old. Her name is Wallace Ann Stamper. She has an older sister named Lacey, and it's about their relationship. Lacey is what they used to call an idiot savant. She is musically gifted, but she is mute. As she can hear, she can see, but she just doesn't speak and does not communicate at all. But you give her an instrument and you play something and she picks it up. Anyway, it's a story about their special relationship, and they are forced from their home by a flood in the very beginning of the book. A flood tears them apart, and it's really a story about survival and the sister's relationship, and how the younger sister, Wallace Ann, comes to understand her sister's differences through the course of the story. And there's a little bit of a young love thing in there and a jealousy factor thrown in, too.
Is it also written in first person, like
yes,
Dixie Dupree?
Yes, it is. It's
written. Do you find that easy to do, or?
I like it because it's a more intimate relationship that you end up with that particular character. I feel like I can just crawl right inside their head and sort of give the reader a closer perspective of what this individual is experiencing and thinking. And so I just look at it as a more intimate way of connecting the story with the reader. After that, I actually just learned, and my agent and I have joked about this a little bit, we have had some strange dates for things to happen to us with contracts. So when a different book completely, Dixie had not sold yet. And so back in February of 2015, there was a Friday the 13th that a book of mine went on submission, a completely different book. It was called A Blackwater Season. It was a hard crime novel. I was just trying something different. Wasn't written in first person. Took me 18 months of hair pulling exercise on that. And so that book went on submission, and the first editor that had a chance to read it and respond to it, he rejected it, but he wanted to see something else. He liked the writing enough to see something else, and my agent sent him The Education of Dixie Dupree. And 6 weeks later, I had actually kind of forgot about him having this manuscript for Dixie Dupree because I was still focused on the other 8 editors that the hard crime novel was out to. But anyway, on April Fool's Day, we had the offer on Dixie Dupree. And then on Valentine's Day, I had already submitted a proposal for a third book, and we received word that we had a 2-book deal from the same publisher, same editor. And so anyway, Friday the 13th, April Fool's Day, and Valentine's Day now for the next contract for 2 books.
That's fantastic. So you've really had a whirlwind. It all, you waited, and then all of a sudden, boom, it all happened.
Late bloomer.
Hey, better a late bloomer than not one at all. That's fantastic.
Exactly. Yes, I'm very excited about that. I've been on an emotional high ever since. It was just perfect timing because I had these events coming up, you know, of course, this week here between Mississippi and here in Memphis. Just all of that good news, too, to help kind of bolster me along. And it's just been very exciting, thrilling.
Well, good. Well, I'm glad we can share that excitement with you. And I can't wait for the new one to come out. It sounds fascinating. It really does.
I think readers will like it. Readers not only of Dixie Dupree, but I think there'll be some new readers, too, hopefully, that will take a look at it. You know, it's a, as usual, I like, as my family knows, I like to put my characters through hell. And then I like to give them a hopeful ending. So,
well, that's good. And I think that Dixie Dupree definitely fits that bill. And I appreciate you sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Donna. We've reached the end of our time today. I've been talking with Donna Everhart about her book, The Education of Dixie Dupree, published by Kensington. I'm Linda Lloyd, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.